The story of Gideon as we continue our series, Who's That? Stories of little known characters in the Bible. So turn to Judges chapter 6 and 7, if you would. Judges 6 and 7, I'm not going to be reading the whole thing. We'll be kind of walking through both of them. I'll be reading verses here and there throughout. So if you turn on that to 200. I need my glasses for seeing far now. That's terrible. 208 to 210, if you're here at Horizon. Ken Wagner asked if I would do a series on Gideon. He, in his email, wrote to me, I'd like to know more about Gideon, what you know or might discover. I guess my interest in Gideon is prompted by my granddaughter's and her husband named their son, now 3 years old, Gideon, so that would be a great-grandchild named Gideon. And then his membership in Gideon's International. So he's like, let me hear about that. Like, okay, we can do that. So the story of Gideon begins in chapter 6 of Judges and goes through chapter 8. We're just looking at chapter 6 and 7. And the story of Gideon is introduced like the story of all the judges. Again, the Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord. Like a broken record, you know. It just continues. And they did evil in the sight of the Lord. So this time God used the Midianites to bring punishment to the people. Really, it was supposed to be discipline because it was supposed to bring them back to God. The Midianites, the little history on the Midianites, on the bottom right-hand corner, the Midianites lived down here. This is the Sinai Peninsula. They lived on this side of the Sinai Peninsula. And they were the offspring of Abraham and his wife Keturah. So after Sarah passed, in Genesis 25, verse 1, after Sarah passed, he married Keturah. They had 6 children that are recorded in Scripture, and one of them was Midian. And these are the Midianites, the offspring of Abraham and Keturah. Of course, the Israelites were the offspring of Abraham and Sarah, with Isaac and Jacob, and then we know the story after that. Later in history, Moses, in the time of the Egyptians, in the time of slavery, fled Pharaoh and went to the Midianites. Why did he go to the Midianites? Well, their extended family. Went to the Midianites. He met his wife Zipporah there. His father-in-law Jethro was a priest of the Midian, people of Midian. And Moses and his brother-in-law, Hobab, remember Hobab from last week? Hobab was the father of the Kenites. Jael was a Kenite. So there was that connection there. And so we have relationships and kinship, and we have all these connections. But at some point, the connection between the people of Midian and the people of the Hebrew people was broken. And that was broken when the Moabites, or the Midianites, joined the Moabites to curse the Israelites. Got that? Then the question was, like, who are the Moabites? Moabites were the descendants of Moab, Moabites, who Moab was the son of Lot, and Lot and Abraham were the ones who went to the land of Canaan, and Abraham gave Lot first choice, and Lot took all the good land and gave Abraham the leftovers, but God's promise came through Abraham. So you got this whole mixed up family. You thought your family was a mess. Nothing compared to this. So here we have this situation where the Midianites, who are family technically, but they're, you know, out there, are now enemies. When it was really bad, when there was a lack of rain, famine in the land. Thank you. Glad you helped me on that one. Yeah, no idea what was going through my head, and neither did I. So there's a huge famine in the land. Last few years, the Midianites would go up to the land of Canaan because the Canaan was a land flowing with. And so when they had no food, they went up there and they raided and they took over. And so for 7 years, what's happening is the people in Midian came up and raided their land. When the cops were good, they'd come in, they'd take them all, they'd take the animals, they'd just be a total, make a total mess of the whole situation, and then they'd leave. The Midianites rode camels. And so they would come up carrying their heavy loads. They'd get all this stuff. They'd carry it all back. Camels could go up to 100 miles a day. So 100 miles is from here to Rock Falls, if you want to go west, or to downtown Milwaukee, if you want to go north. And they could cover that in a day, and camels didn't need to drink and stop and drink because, of course, they're camels. And so they would come in, and the Israelites would never have any idea they were coming because they could make that trip in like a day. And they'd come out from way out, and they'd never see them coming. So they were always living in fear of the people of Midian who were coming in. And so the Israelites would just hide in the caves when they would come. So they cried out to God, and God sent an unnamed prophet in verses 7 through 10. They said a prophet came, an unnamed prophet doesn't give a name of who that is. And he basically, the prophet said, yeah, you're getting this from the people of Midian because you turned away from God. This is your own fault. I'm amazed as I've been studying all these things and looking at, as they cry out to God, the people of Israel cry out to God, and I was working on a devotion for Psalm 74 this week for a prayer guide for strategic renewal we'll be putting out. And Asaph writes to God, and this is post-Babylon, and he's like, where are you, God? Why are you left us? Why are you treating us this way? It's like, the people of Israel would turn once again away from God. God would do this, and then they're wondering why God's doing this. They're not the brightest lot of people. Then again, we aren't either. So they cried out. This unnamed prophet came and said, here's why you're experiencing punishment, because you are turning away from God. That's why I'm here. So we come up to verse 11. And here we're introduced to Gideon. Let me find verse. And the angel of the Lord came and sat down under an oak in Ophrah, that's how you pronounce that, Ophrah, that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in the winepress to keep it from the Midianites. Okay, so let's just pause here for a minute. So you see where Gideon's at. He's in a winepress. He's threshing wheat to hide from the Midianites. Not out in the middle, not out, you know, he's hiding. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, oftentimes that is just a phrase that talks about an angel of the Lord is the presence of God, so God appeared. Angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon. He said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Okay, let's pause there. Do you see the irony that scaredy cat Gideon in the wine press is called mighty warrior? Pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied, but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hands of Midian. The Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? Pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied, but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. The Lord answered, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive. So here God shows up and calls him a mighty warrior as he's hiding in a wine press. And he says, you know, God says, I'm going to send you out, mighty warrior. And Gideon basically says, I'm the wimpiest of the wimps. Why are you calling me? I'm the least of the least. Why are you calling me? I'm not going to do this. You don't. So Gideon asked for a sign. And continuing and on past verse 16, he offers proper hospitality to the angel of the Lord, to the Lord. He goes off, he makes a meal, he butchers, slaughters a goat, he cooks the goat, he cooks the meal. This is proper hospitality. If you go to the Middle East, they still have hospitality. If you go in and you don't offer dinner or offer something, that's the epitome of rudeness. So if I were to go to your house and you know, just stop by to say hi, and you didn't offer at least a cup of coffee or offer something, then I would, in that culture, interpret that as you just being incredibly rude. You know, to me, it's like, hey, I got somewhere to go in 10 minutes, so just, you know, whatever. You know, we different culture. Put your mind, you know, yourself in that mindset. So he offers this. You know, it takes a while, and so sitting down for a while, I mean, it's part of sitting there. It's not just quick in and out. I mean, this was a whole day affair now. He makes a meal, but he wants a sign from God. So he says, I want a sign. And so the angel of the Lord, he prepares a meal, puts it before God. And then the angel of the Lord instructs him, put it on the rock. So he put the meal on the rock. He put the bread on the rock. And with the end of his staff, he went, and the thing went, read it for yourself. It basically, I mean, the whole thing disappeared, and then God disappeared, and that was it. I mean, you just kind of think like a modern, you know, movie. You know, it's like, zap, all gone. Like, what? And so Gideon has this sign. So then it continues in verse 25 through 32 that after Gideon appears in weakness, there's this challenge. That for Gideon to be used by God to make things right. But so Gideon, in order to be used by God, has to make things right with his family. So his family had Baal and Asherah poles. So they were worshiping the gods of the land. And basically, God's like, if you want to be used by me, you got to take care of your mess at home. So he was to cleanse his family of all the altars to the Canaanite gods, and he was going to knock them down and burn them up. And if you read the story, he does this at night because he's afraid. So he goes under the cloak of darkness, knocks his stuff down, and burns it all up, and he goes out there. So it wasn't just about cleaning out some, you know, old used furniture that they don't want around the house. This is an attack on their belief system. Gideon attacks his family's belief system because for the last number of years, since they had done evil in the sight of the Lord, they'd been believing and worshiping these Asherah poles and Asherah and Baal gods. So the men of Gideon and the town that he came up came after Gideon. And they don't go after Gideon directly. They go after Joash, who's the father of the clan, much in keeping with collectivist culture. So the culture of the day is, in our culture today is, if you have a problem with me, you come talk to me. In that culture, it's very much, if you have a problem with me, then you go talk to my dad. Well, my father's not been alive for years, so you'd have to go talk to my brother, because he's the oldest. In the culture of the day, you wouldn't go and deal with the problem, you'd go deal with the father of the clan. And so they go to the father of the clan, they go to Joash and say, your kid did this, even though he's a full-grown adult. Joash is still the father of the clan. And we see, when you look at Joseph and Jacob and Joseph, you know, Joseph had the coat, and his brothers didn't like him. Well, the thing that the father of the clan is supposed to do is keep peace within the clan. He's the father of the clan. He's the one who keeps peace within the clan. He's the one who protects the whole clan and the family. And so they go to the father, and they say, you know, look at what he did. And the father's job was to protect them. And so we see here Joash doing his job. A misreading of Scripture would be that Gideon needed his daddy to step up for him because he's chicken and he's too afraid. And I, in my reading this week, that was one of the, you know, he needed daddy to protect him. Well, that's not the culture. That might be our culture, but that's not his culture. So in keeping with their cultural norms, Joash, the father, stands up to protect his clans. And these people are coming after him and saying, look what he did. So what does Joash do? He makes the turn here. The issue about the honor of God, the god Baal. So he makes this turn that he says, well, if Baal is truly your god, then shouldn't your powerful god not need any intervention by humans? Isn't your god powerful enough to take care of himself? Now that puts these people in a bind, because if they have to go after Gideon themselves, then they dishonor their god because they're saying their god's not powerful enough. You see what he did? You see what Joash did there? He made this thing, in a sense, he made this thing about Baal's honor. And if Baal's not going to take care of it, why does he need you? So they named him Jerubbaal. let Baal contend with him, because they couldn't go and they couldn't defend Baal, because Joab says, was your God not big enough, strong enough that you have to defend him for? So they didn't touch him. See how they made the honor, that be an issue of honor to protect. So they continue in verse 33 through 40, where we see the ongoing battle, that's really the wrong word, the ongoing struggle that Gideon has with God about being called to go take on the Midianites. So verse 33 through 40. Now all the Midianites and Amalekites and all the other Kites, no, all the other eastern people, joined forces and crossed over the Jordan, encamped in the Valley of Jezreel. Okay, so just a pause here for those of you who were last week. The Valley of Jezreel is also the Kishon River Valley. So they're in the same place of the battle that we looked at last week with Deborah and Jael and Barak. Then the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abiezerites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also to Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet with them. Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the rest of the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand as you said. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day, and he squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece, but this time make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew. That night God did so. Only the fleece was dry, and the whole ground was covered with dew. So here we see Gideon asking for God for a sign. But in verse 34, it says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. We saw that last week, didn't we? And the Spirit of the Lord came upon who? Who was it? Last week, Spirit of the Lord came upon. Really? Nobody remembers? Is it Jael? Deborah? What? That was Deborah. Spirit of the Lord came upon Deborah, I think. I might be wrong on that one. Well, I'll have to go back and re-watch the video from last week to remember. Anyhow, Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. And when we think about the Spirit of the Lord coming upon somebody, we put that in a positive context, generally. That this person is spiritually, you know, sound and ready to... ready to do some, and we presuppose this is a spiritually mature person that the Spirit of the Lord came upon. But that doesn't presuppose any spirituality or spiritual maturity on the part of the recipient. Because we think that the Spirit of the Lord is going to come on the mature, but coming on Gideon is an intrusion of God into the human experience, where God takes somebody who's ill-disposed, in this case, doesn't want to do what God wants him to do. So Gideon doesn't want to do what God wants to do. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon him so that he was equipped to do what God wanted him to do. So this was not a positive thing in a sense that Gideon was this spiritually, you know, mature person. In the case of Gideon, the Spirit's work reflects God's sovereign will to set into motion the deliverance that he planned, and it's not a condition of Gideon's faith or his spirituality. So here Gideon is hesitating. His almost immediate fleecing of God speaks to his unbelief, his lack of spirituality, his lack of faith. He asks God for a sign. So he puts this fleece out. Now, you probably maybe at some point heard a sermon that said, this is great, you know, Gideon is discerning God's will. No, Gideon knew God's will. He made it pretty clear when they were sitting there talking face to face. No, Gideon is putting this thing on the ground because he's trying to get out of it. He's trying to manipulate God because it's like, if God doesn't show up, then I don't have to do this. In spite of the polite requests, that Gideon brings to God, we shouldn't be blind to the manner that he's trying to manipulate God to get out of it. But God, here in his divine sovereignty, in his incredibly patient love, allows Gideon just one more time to demonstrate his lack of faith and to show him that God is in charge. I mean, you look at Gideon. No other judge talked face to face with God. There's no other time that a judge sits down with God in person. There's no other judge that gets this much divine assurance of what his plan was. There's no other judge that gets in such definitiveness what God wants to do. And there's no other judge that shows more doubt. And there's no other judge that shows more fear. And there's no other judge that tries to manipulate God to try to get out of it. The whole fleecing process here is nothing short of a lack of faith on Gideon's part. And the amazing thing is God's patient with it. That's what the author wants us to see. As if having a conversation with God face to face wasn't enough, as if having his meal smoked right in front of him wasn't enough, if it wasn't enough that God put the fleece out and answered this weak faith request twice, God still is patient with Gideon. And so we see that they're getting ready to go into battle now that God is, you know, incredibly patient with Gideon. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 7. They go into battle, they get ready for battle, and then here God, after Gideon calls all those to come fight with him, basically says, you got way too many men. So if you pause a minute, and don't read it now, but if you go back and read chapter 6 and 7, you'll find, I think four times, it could be five, I don't remember right off the top of my head, that the author is writing that the Midianites were too great to count. They were like locusts when they filled the valley. And four or five times they basically said, there are so many of them that you can't count them. And it made it like inundated. They're all over the place. And they have all these men come together, and God says, yeah, you got too many. Ask those who are really afraid, that don't really want to be here, you know, give them an opportunity to go home. So Gideon gave them the opportunity. And a whole bunch went home. Did you see? If you look at here, there it is right there. Yeah, 22,000 men left while 10,000 remained. So they went from 32,000 to 10,000. I don't know about you, but if I were leading an army, I think I'd still want the scared ones. I mean, at least you have a bunch, you know, a whole bigger number. But they left, and then God said, nope, you got 10,000, you still got too many. And so they're leading to drink, and at some point they go to drink, and they're sitting by the stream, and God says, take the ones who lapped their water from the stream out of their hand, and not the ones who bent down to drink directly out of the water. So he had three. Why did he do it that way? So the ones that are down on the ground, make sure I don't go off camera here. The ones who are down on the ground, if they're lapping with their hand like this, what position are they in? They've got a stick, their weapon in their one hand yet, and they're still drinking this way. If you go and drink directly from the stream, like this, you think if your face is all the way in the water, you have any protection at all. So he takes basically the 300 smartest ones. The ones who are, you know, aware of their situation and, you know, keeping their head up and alert. And so with the group with 300 seem to be the most elite men. And so Gideon is still fearful. So he wants another sign from God. I don't know if I can do this with only 300 men. So in verse 8 through 15a of chapter 7. Oh, 7. Let's start at verse 7. The Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men that had lapped, I will save you and the Midianites into your hands, or give you the Midianites into your hands. Let all the rest go home. So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites home, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and the trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley, so they're up on the top of a hill. I'll show you the map in a minute. During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up, go down against the camp, because I'm going to give you to your hands. If you are afraid to attack, it's almost like he knew he was still scared, go down to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they are saying. Afterward, you will be encouraged to attack the camp. So he and Purah went to his servant, went down to the outpost of the camp. The Midianites and the Amalekites and all the other eastern people had settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. I had a dream, he was saying. A round loaf of barley bread came and stumbled into the Midianite camp, and it struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed. His friend responded, this can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and his whole camp into his hands. When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he bowed down and worshipped. I'm going to pause there in the middle of that verse. One quick note, why barley bread? Barley was an inferior grain. It was like a trash grain. You know, if you're going to have bread, you're going to make it out of wheat or you're going to make it out of something. And so basically he said, this junk over here came into our camp, right? So maybe he was kind of insulting him in his dream, you know, with the dream. And so barley was not like, you know, you're not going to go out to eat at a fancy restaurant and they're going to give you barley. It's kind of like, okay, you got to have something. So here they come in, you know, Gideon is still scared of the Midianites. God says, send him, and he overhears this dream, and God once again gives him another sign. Did you notice what Gideon's response was then? Gideon worshipped. The irony is rich. Hearing the promise directly from the mouth of God himself did not convince Gideon. His fleece signs didn't convince him, but hearing it from the lips of a Midianite soldier who had a dream interpreted by another Midianite soldier finally convinced him. And now Gideon worships God. And so he gets this small band that he has, it's 300 men, and at this moment it appears he believes God. Even though he appeared to him in person, even though he appeared to him in smoke, you know, the dinner went up in smoke, even though they had the fleece twice, you know, now he hears it. And so he gets ready to go. The Midianites are in the valley of Jezreel, and the Kishon River throws through there. There's lots of battles in that. And here's the battle scene. It would be good if I kept up with my PowerPoint. Sorry about that. So here's the battle scene. So here's the valley of Jezreel. You remember last week we talked about Deborah and Jael, and here is where that two mountains come together and they fought that battle in here. Well, here they're on the other side of the valley. They're right here. Gideon has circled his enemy right there. And so they go into this. The army gathers at Ophrah. They go to the Herod's well, or the spring of Herod, and they set up camp. Remember, battles take, I mean, this is not just like a week type thing. This takes a long time for them to get ready to fight. This is where, on the top of this hill, that the people of, or Gideon, his people, were spying on him from over the top of the hill down into the valley. So they're looking into the valley, and then the Midianites are in the valley, and God says, okay, now you can go. So the people go down there, but at the same time, God gives them instruction, but Gideon's still, I mean, Gideon's pretty wise in this. He has the 300 soldiers. The 300 of them were going down. But did you notice earlier that it said that they kept the trumpets and all the provisions? Did you catch that? So they're going into battle. They're going in with the 300 soldiers. Each of them has a torch hidden in an earthen jar, and each of them has a trumpet. And so they're going down in pitch darkness. And it says that they waited till the watch changed. So the changing of the guard. Well, why would they wait till the changing of the guard? Why is that an important little fact? Because when, and you know this too, if you ever go in from the place that's lit, that you're hanging out inside playing, you know, if you're going camping or somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, you're inside, you're playing cards, and all of a sudden you need to go outside. And you go outside, and you know it takes a little while to get used to the darkness to be able to hear. And so this is the changing of the watch where the new guards are coming out who are not used to the dark yet. They're not acclimated. Need more coffee. They're not acclimated to the dark yet, and so they're not. And so that's why they did it there. So now that you've got 300 men. Who each have their own trumpet and each have their own torch, and they break them and they blow the trumpet. But why is this important fact too? Important fact because when you go into battle, not everybody has a trumpet. So one trumpet would be for like 100 people. And not everybody is going to be carrying a torch because you got to have other people, you know, carrying their weapons. So by carrying everybody carrying a trumpet and everybody carrying a torch, the assumption that the Midianites now make as they are coming from three different sides is that this is a massive army and we're toast. And so by the element of surprise at night gives Gideon the advantage because the enemy couldn't use their archers because they couldn't see. They couldn't use their pikemen, which is the guys who have the big long spear and go out in front and jab people. They couldn't use them because it's dark. And by coming at night, they played on the fears and suspicions of the Midianites. And they startled the army in the middle of the dark. And they began fighting each other. And so then they flee. They get blocked off here, so they can't go this way. They get blocked off, and so they have to flee down the Jordan River Valley between, you can see on the topographical map here, that there's the river here, but there's mountains there, so they kind of get this cattle chute type thing. And they get taken out there because if they tried to cross the river, they couldn't. Finally, they tried to cross the river down here, but they gave word to Ephraim. Ephraim was ready to snatch them and get them on the way through. Gideon wins. The Midianites are routed. And once again, God saves Israel. So what do we take away from the lesson of Gideon? Again, moralism isn't the answer. I was watching a sermon this past week in my doing study, and the beginning of it is like, we're going to learn from the hero Gideon. Like, we can't really say Gideon was a hero and now we got to learn from Gideon, because when God met Gideon in person, he doubted. When he still wasn't sure, Gideon tried to manipulate God. And when he still wasn't sure, he feared. And he learned very, very slowly. Yeah, be like that. That's a great sermon. Rather, when we see the story of Gideon, we see that God is faithful through the life of Gideon in spite of his own weakness, in spite of his own fear, in spite of his own family conflict, in spite of his own family turning away, in spite of his own doubt, in spite of overwhelming odds, that God uses him. God brought him to a moment when all of his confidence is gone, when everything that he has is gone, not that he had a whole lot of confidence to begin with, but then God leads him to victory. In spite of Gideon's lack of faith, in spite of his lack of trust, in spite of his fear, God uses Gideon to save the people of Israel. If we look at our own lives, in many ways, we're not that far from Gideon. How many times has God told us, and we know God says, go this way, and he's like, I don't think so. I don't know about that. You know, God tells us something, he makes it pretty clear, and then we kind of, you know, the same thing as Gideon did. Are you sure? And God can still use us. In many ways, God has to break down the same walls that he broke down with Gideon to uncover our fear and uncover our insecurity and uncover our excuses and uncover our wrestling and fighting against God, so that he can use us. And yet he still does. In his patience, he still uses us. When we want all the answers until we go for it, I'm not going forward without all the answers, which God, you know, generally never gives. He just says, trust me. Do we follow? We depend on a whole lot of stuff for our own security. We depend upon our investments or our kids or our future earnings or our reputation or our family or our own smarts or our own whatever, fill in the blank, which you think you're depending upon for your future. And realize when God says go or follow, we need to follow. Even when it doesn't make sense, even when we have fear, even when we're not sure what's going on next. I think the point of the story is that God in his sovereignty uses the weak, the incapable, the fearful, and the doubting to do his work so that he can be glorified. And people can look at God and say, that's who our God is. We just have to be willing to follow. And when we do poorly, God's still patient with us. Let's pray. God, thank you for these words of Gideon in which we see ourselves oftentimes far too clearly. But Lord, thank you that you use us in spite of ourselves sometimes. Use us, God, to continue to be at work in your kingdom, however it is or wherever it is that you're leading or however it is that you placed us. God, help us to maybe just a little bit better have faith and follow you in all of these things so that you might be glorified and that people would be drawn to you.